Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack.
Welcome to episode 46 of Top Shelf at Merrick Library. I am your host, Carol Ann Tack, and thanks as always, listeners, for joining me. Ivy Lynn was a thief, but you would never know it to look at her. Maybe that was the problem. No one ever suspected, and that made her reckless. That is the very first sentence of this powerful debut novel by today's guest and now best-selling author, Susie Yang. Susie Yang, thank you so very much for joining me today on Top Shelf at Merrick Library Podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor to be here.
First, I want to say congratulations on being the November selection for Read with Jenna and for making the New York Times bestseller list. I have to ask you, how did you get the news? Like, how does this happen for a debut author? Does someone call you and say, guess what, Read with Jenna, or guess what, you're on the New York Times bestseller list? Who contacts you?
It really is just exactly like what you said. For the Read with Jenna, I'd been sitting on the news for, because it's a November pick, but I think my editor had emailed me, I want to say it's August or September, and it's exactly what you said. The headline is, oh my God, congratulations, White Ivy has been selected for the Read with Jenna, but it was confidential until November, you know, so we were really excited by that. And that was really special. And then the New York Times bestseller list, I don't keep track of it. I don't know when the list comes out or anything like that, and had zero expectation. And I was actually preparing for a podcast with Scott Simon from NPR. So I was nervous about that already. So I was sort of on my phone, and I get an email from my editor at Simon & Schuster, and she said, get on Zoom right now. And she sent me the link. And I was like, oh my God, what happened? What's wrong? You know, my first thought was that I had an event that I had forgotten about. Do you know what I mean? Like an event schedule that I was, you know, that I was missing. So I get on Zoom and my entire Simon & Schuster team is there and my agent is there, and they said, congratulations, you're a New York Times bestseller, because I think they get the list, I suppose, earlier than when it actually comes out.
Correct.
So yeah, so they told me that they had been waiting the whole day, but nobody had informed me because I suppose they didn't want me to be nervous and all that stuff, which thank God they didn't. So it really is just, I think all the good news comes through through email these days. Yeah.
That is really, really something. I was just about to say, you've done so many interviews for this book. You've been on with the Seth Meyers podcast and PR. And for stopping off here with me at the Merrick Library Top Shelf podcast is more than I really can thank you for.
No, don't be silly. To me, I mean, I love talking to librarians. I love talking to, I don't know, the people who I would have listened to when I was reading and getting books recommended to me. It's still such a new experience. So it still feels like sort of a privilege to be able to talk about it. Yeah.
I also heard that the queen of TV, the queen of Netflix and media mogul, Ms. Shonda Rhimes, will executive produce a miniseries of White Ivy for Netflix. You're kidding me, right?
Yeah, that news came very similarly to the other ones. It was an email that fell from the sky one day.
I mean, that must have been so overwhelming. Like, who do you tell? Who's the first person that you contact? Do you tell your husband? Do you call your parents? Like, how does that work?
My husband was with me. So yeah, we got the email from my film agent, and he had gotten the manuscript a few years ago when we had first sold it. But because I was still working through, you know, drafts with my editor, he was holding off kind of having other people read it. And so when I finished the final draft earlier this year, I knew that he was sort of going out with it. So we got some interest from various production companies and networks in the beginning of June. And that, you know, the process took a whole month. But the craziest moment of that was when, like halfway through, he said, okay, right now, Shonda Land has expressed interest and Shonda Rhimes is reading it right now. And I could not do anything the whole evening. I wanted to have someone broadcast what page she was on. Like, I wanted to see her expression. So the whole night, I just kept on thinking, Shonda Rhimes is reading my book. Shonda Rhimes is reading my book. And that was so surreal. And then the next day, he emailed me to say she had finished and really loved it. And so we ended up deciding to go with, obviously, Shonda Land and Netflix in the end.
I mean, when I first heard about the book, Simon & Schuster actually sent me a galley. And I was really floored when I read it. And then Simon & Schuster invited all their librarians to their fall 2020 editorial presentation, which is just so much fun because you were the guest speaker. And in the comment section, it was really hard for me to not ask a million questions without spoiling the book. How was that event for you?
it felt really embarrassing in a way because I had to do a PowerPoint presentation on myself, which I never thought I would need to do that. You know, it felt like I was, I joke about it. It felt like I was presenting at like my own funeral or some wedding, you know what I mean? Where I'm like, this is the life of Susie Yang. So it was a little bit self-conscious where I was putting together the PowerPoint, but I wanted to tell my thank you. It was a team effort because my Maggie and Mary Sue at Simon Schuster, they would ask for specific photos. So I would pull up photos of me reading as a child or me at pharmacy school. So it was a good walk down memory lane, and it made me nostalgic, you know, because I can see how far I've come from when I was a kid and really loved books. So it was a good experience, definitely.
It's great for the librarians because it adds a different dimension to the story when we have the background about the author. And I love that PowerPoint, by the way, which I, among other things, it was great. So you did A+. It's probably felt like you were presenting back in when you went through your doctorate, you had to sit in front of all of these people and present your thesis. You're sitting in front of all these librarians. What I loved about that presentation is you do speak about your background, being born in China, coming to the United States as a child. And then you talk about receiving your doctorate of pharmacy from Rutgers University. And then you launch a tech startup in San Francisco, which has taught, 20,000 people how to code? I could barely get my mascara on for this podcast. Even though no one can see me, I want to make sure the author looks at me and says, okay, she's at least she's presentable. Somewhere in all of that, a novelist is born. Where in there did you get your bug for creative writing?
I think my story is actually quite similar to a lot of, I was just on a panel the other day with other Asian American writers. And I think all of us have that story of all of us were bookworms. We've always been writing as a hobby, but we had never really considered a career path because the Chinese expectation of our parents is get a good job, right? Study something technical in college. And I was just so surprised. Even, I think one of the writers I was speaking to, she said the same thing. She said, I didn't even know what an MFA was until she became an adult, right? And that was exactly my experience as well. So my whole life I've been writing for fun. Would actually get in trouble for reading and writing by my parents because I wasn't studying, you know? So for me, it was always such a love, and it was something that I did on my own. And it wasn't until I did the pharmacy degree, which I hated and realized I wasn't cut out to be a pharmacist, as you heard before. And then when I did, after I, you know, ran my startup for a few years, I thought, oh, I can't, you know, I can't put my life on hold anymore. It was really just settling, kind of building the courage to say, I actually want to be a writer and see if I can do it professionally. And that was, you know, to me, that took a lot of courage on my part. And I wrote the book in secret because I was too afraid to tell people that I was trying to write something. And because it's such a differing track from what I had been doing professionally. And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned like building up the identity of a novelist, because I never really felt a strong association with the label of a career person. Do you know what I mean? I think a lot of people say, I am this, you know, I am a librarian or I am a scientist. And that just never felt true to me because it doesn't feel like I've changed. You know, my book, the things that I love are still the same. And, you know, I think there is a side of me that's still very entrepreneurial. I think I apply deadlines in a way to writing, and I take that from my tech life. So to me, it doesn't feel like I've changed, even though the label, you know, that people say, okay, now you're an author versus you're an entrepreneur versus you're a pharmacist. That's very exterior to me, but it doesn't feel like my interests have changed. Yeah.
A purely non-book question. But while you were writing White Ivy, was it hard to disconnect from the company and from all of the tech aspects of it? Like, did you check the trades? Did you keep an ear on the industry wall? Because even though I am a public librarian, I spent 25, 30 years as a corporate librarian. So knowing what's going on in investment banking or in that corporate world, still to this day, and I'm out of it for a while, I'm still always like, oh, I wonder what's going on. Was that hard for you to do that?
Yeah, no, I really haven't changed. Like even now, my Twitter is half writers and publishing and half tech thought leaders and startups that I think are interesting or making innovations in biotech. So to me, those are just my interests. You feel like I'm really interested. And to me, the commonality is really just people working really hard to bring something to fruition. I really love that it's the story of you have an idea and you're trying to bring it to life. And there's so many struggles along the way. And that always inspires me. Like people working hard for a very long off dream really inspires me. And those are the stories I've always liked anyway. So even when I was writing White Ivy, I would get emails, you know, I respond to customer emails. But at that point, I'd been running Base Rails, which was the startup for 3 to 4 years. It was an online learning platform. So essentially, the content was already there. So I didn't have to put in, you know, more effort. It was really just running on its own. So that's why I could even have the ability to take the year to write full time.
To continue your thought, you don't stop becoming one thing because all of a sudden you're an author. So just because I left this corporate world doesn't mean I still don't have an interest in financial service research and doing, I mean, I loved that. And I there are days where I really miss it.
Yeah.
So even though I make this switch from, say, private sector to public sector, and now podcasting, and then I'm doing all these other Facebook Lives, it's still just other interests that I have that I love to do. So I think that's a good point. You're not just a librarian. You're not just an author. It's a lot of other things that make up Suzy Yang. When you make the decision to devote the time to the writing, did the story of Ivy Lynn in White Ivy, did that come to you first? Or did you sort of, I guess my question is for White Ivy, were you a plotter? Were you a pantser? Like, what came first, the chicken or the egg?
For me, it was what type of story. So I think the spark for me is always, what is it that I want to say? And usually that comes in the form of like a theme, you know, or sort of like a character arc. And so the inspiration, even before I had the character of Ivy, before the plot, I knew that I wanted to write about an anti-hero. And I knew that her trajectory was going to sort of be her downfall. It wasn't going to be a love story. You know, it wasn't going to be a mystery. It was going to be specifically a character study of one person going to great lengths and essentially bringing about her own destruction. I was really obsessed with that idea, that, you know, that kind of anti-hero going down a dark path type of story. And when I had that idea, I thought, okay, now what kind of character? And that's when the first line of the book, Ivy Lynn was a thief, which you had read out loud in the beginning of the podcast, that came to me. And then I wrote the first chapter in one day. And that's been relatively the same. And it was this idea of a girl who was a thief and she was shoplifting at Kmart, but her looks are very childlike and plain and unassuming. So people won't suspect her. And that became, I thought, oh, what an interesting girl. And as she grows up, and I really love books that follow a character through many years. So I wanted to incorporate that as well into my book. And then after I had those elements in place, the plot came to me very organically. So I would say the skeleton of the book haven't changed since the day I thought of Ivy.
And I know you've been through this so many times before, and I appreciate your patience with me asking again. But for our listeners, can you tell us about White Ivy?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So White Ivy tells the story of Ivy Lynn, who is a Chinese American immigrant, and we follow her from when she's 14 to 27. So as a child, she goes to a very rich private school on scholarship, and she meets a boy named Gideon Speyer, who is the son of a Massachusetts state senator. And as adults, Ivy and Gideon reconnect when Ivy is a teacher. And essentially, the story follows Ivy as she kind of lies and schemes and manipulates her way into Gideon's heart, into marrying his very New England, waspy, very wealthy family. And to me, the pleasure of writing it was really to see, you know, how far is Ivy willing to go to get what she wants? And what does she sacrifice on this journey into kind of seeking this life of privilege that she's felt has been denied her?
For sure. And I want to say that when I did read the book and I put it down, I turned to my 22-year-old daughter and I said to her, you have to read this. She loved it. She found it compelling. That's what makes White Ivy so perfect. It's perfectly positioned as a contemporary thriller for all readers and all book clubs, which is why I think it's connecting and resonating with so many readers. And I can't wait till the Top Shelf listeners get their hands on it. I think this quote from Mary Sue Rucci, who's the editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster, says it best when she says that White Ivy turns the immigrant novel on its head. A love triangle and an exploration of class and race identity. It's a page turner that explores our obsession with upward mobility through a character who is unapologetic about her goals. Yes, but I also feel that even though Ivy is unapologetic, I don't know if I'm in the minority or not, but I don't want to say I was rooting for her, but I felt very sympathetic towards her. And I don't know what that says about me. But I was appreciative of her efforts, but she was driven. And I really appreciated seeing that you made the reader go along with Ivy on her journey.
Thank you. I really appreciate that because, you know, that was my goal. I early on knew, I thought, I do not want to make Ivy a sociopath. You know, I don't want this to be the story of a sociopath, right? I want her to be understandable, and I want the readers to understand her motivations and, you know, I can understand very clearly where she's coming from, regardless of whether they like her or root for her, or, you know, I don't think anyone agrees with her. So it was really just a matter of keeping the point of view very close to Ivy so that we understand her thoughts and we can sympathize with her insecurities, you know, and we have a bigger vision of her ambitions than she does. You know, we understand what she's losing and the imperfections of what it is that she's striving for, even though she doesn't, which is very human. You know, we always see our friends' problems and their shortcomings, but it's so hard to see our own, right?
What I most appreciate about Ivy is her honesty. She has lines in this book that I have underlined and highlighted that just leave me with these like oof moments. After you read that, you're like, holy cow. When you write Ivy and you get these perfect sentences that encapsulate her, how is that for you? You have to get into, you are in essence as the writer, you are the voice of Ivy Lynn.
Right. Oh, that's so interesting. So in my experience, the sentences and emotions that readers have told me they loved are not ones that stand out to me as a writer. Right. So I love that though, you know, because I can really love a sentence and think, oh, I articulated that really well, but that's not necessarily the ones that, you know, my husband or a friend or a reader will say. And the ones that, you know, other people will tell me, oh, I really love this sentence, it will surprise me because I'll think, oh, I sort of forgot about it, or it was in the moment. So I think I really appreciate that every reader, different aspects of her personality will resonate with them. So to me, I can't really say, you know, I purposely thought, oh, this is the emotion that I'm trying to say. I think different readers are drawn to different emotions, but just in the sense of me really being close to Ivy, I think it's because the closeness for me comes from, I just wrote so many scenes with her. Like, I'm not precious with my words. I tend to write out every scene. So much of my edits with my editor was cutting and, you know, condensing and taking out scenes that weren't necessary. But because I had written all those scenes, I had such a thorough understanding of how she would react with even the little nuance of her insecurities, or if she's at a party and she's hyper aware of the way that someone looks at her. So things like that, because I wrote so many scenes and I wrote entire sections of her life that weren't included in the book, that's probably why I felt really close to Ivy's point of view as a reader.
She leaps off the page at us.
Thank you.
Amazing. As I said, Ivy's honest. She's honest to herself. She's got these arch, very stark observations. And I think there's a lot of things, like we just said, that readers will agree with or disagree with or be absolutely flabbergasted by. And but you understand where she's coming from. You get her motivations. She is an anti-hero. You mentioned that before. And readers can decide what side they're on, whether you're on Ivy's or something else.
Yeah.
Do readers, or have readers so far, now the book's only been out since what, the beginning of November. Have you had contact with readers who have completely just divided opinions on Ivy in general?
I feel like not completely, actually. You know, people appreciate her point of view. I think that probably the most divided is some people say, oh, I couldn't stand her, but I really enjoy the story. And other people said, I really loved her and rooted for her. So I would say that's the most differing, whether it's like a personal opinion of whether they liked Ivy or not. Right. But the feedback in general about her choices and the arc of the story, I feel like that's been pretty consistent. People feel it's a compelling story and they feel like it's immersive, that type of thing.
Right. Good luck trying to make dinner when you're in the middle of the book. That's what I'm going to say to readers and listeners at this point in time. There's a line that comes very early in the book. She cruises through elementary school. She's neither at the top of her class nor the bottom, neither popular nor unpopular. But it wasn't until she transferred to the Grove Preparatory Day School in sixth grade that she found the central object of her aspirational life, a certain type of clean-cut, all-American boy, hitherto unknown to her. The type of boy who attended Sunday school and plucked daisies for his mother on Mother's Day. His name was Gideon Spire. That sets everything into motion. I know you've probably heard comparisons to Tom Ripley. Ivy is really not very compromising as she assimilates and gets older and tries to make her way into this privileged, wealthy set, she gets more driven and the story gets even darker. When I think of Gideon Spire, I am much older than you, but all I kept thinking about was Christopher Atkins, the actor. He's just like the perfect, when you described him in the book with this curly blonde hair, and I thought, and the blue eyes, and this, I thought, oh my gosh, that's Christopher Atkins I'm thinking of. Younger people will not know who that is. So that's your homework, listeners. Look up Christopher Atkins.
I think all of us have our own version of a Gideon. You know what I mean? We've all known a Gideon in our lives. Like every single person who's grown up in America have our own Gideon. And I think that was the point, really, that this Gideon is not necessarily special to anybody but Ivy.
Because you see that guy, he's either on the basketball team or the football team or, you know, whatever club he's on, and he walks by you in high school and you're just like, oh my goodness. You know, it's just that. It's very, I didn't think of it that way, but you're right. Everybody has a Gideon Spire. She thinks that because of how she looks, she doesn't fit in. She doesn't look like everybody else. She doesn't have the same family like everybody else. And because of her status, she just thinks she's never going to get the boy. And the boy is this ticket to her American dream. And man, she is unapologetic and it is right there on the page. I'm not going to say anything to spoil it, but like I said, good luck trying to make dinner when you're halfway through the book.
That's the best compliment when people say they're losing sleep or they're not cooking dinner for their kids. Oh, I love hearing those. That's the best compliment for an author.
So I still do think of Ivy, even though I read the book over this, I don't know when Rachel sent it to me. I want to say it was in this May or April. I'm not sure when she sent the galley, but it was before we had the presentation to the librarians. And like I said, I'm still thinking about her. And I still go back to the underlined passages that I have in the book, because many of the passages are not just from Ivy, but they're Ivy's mother, Ivy's aunt, and her nan. These are such strong women characters. I love that you brought them, especially the mom's story, her background, into the forefront. I also love that there's all of these very strong women characters.
Yeah, I'm so happy you pointed that out, because I think growing up, I was a really impressionable child and I had a really vivid imagination. And so much of what you realize is even possible is from looking at the other women in your life. So when I meet somebody, a friend or a cousin or a teacher, as a child, you're always trying to absorb. You're trying to say, well, who do I want to be when I grow up? Your childhood very much is that. She's learning from her grandmother at first, and then she's learning from her mom, but opposite lessons. You know, she's saying, I don't want to be like my mom. So she tries to pull away from that. And then she sort of gets taken in by this very wealthy aunt in China, and she learns what it's like to have money, and she learns how to take care of her skin and things like that. And then even as an adult, she's looking to Mary Beth, she's looking to Liana. So I think, I feel like so many women do, you know, I learn from my girlfriends, probably not in the same way Ivy does, but it is that feeling of absorbing how other people live and asking yourself, what do those choices say about them? You know, who am I in comparison? And so I think the idea of strong women and being influenced by them or trying to see yourself reflected in them, it's natural for me and how I live my life too.
And when she looks at her mom and hears more and more of her mom's story, you start looking at your parents as people, not necessarily your parents anymore. And that moment of discovery, it's impactful. That's when you start separating from your childhood. And it's sad at the same time. Well, you know, now you're maturing. I read somewhere that one of the books you had been reading recently was Elena Ferrante's The Lying Life of Adults.
Yes.
Which I just did as a book discussion about a month ago. And I have to tell you, it reminded me of Ivy learning about her mom. Right. Right. You all of a sudden, you are not this adolescent who it changes. You all of a sudden see your parents very differently because something happens. Something is revealed.
That's such a trademark of growing up. You know what I mean? I think so much of growing up is realizing the world for yourself. You know, it's not just what people have told you it is. And I mean, sadly, that is part of it, which is seeing the flaws in your parents or the ways in which they're wrong. And that's a terrifying experience because then you have to discover for yourself. And I love books that illuminate that, right? I think that's why I'm so drawn to coming of age stories, because that moment where you become a woman from a girl is when you start to think on your own. Like I just have such a distinct memory of being 12 and writing in my journal, like I was a lifelong journaler. And I wrote, today is the first day I am awake. And like such a distinct memory, because it really felt like before that, I was just kind of, I have no memories of what I was thinking. It's just, I was a sponge. And then that day I wrote in my journal because it felt like, oh my God, I can think for myself. And it was so, I feel like I'm so drawn to hearing how other women have experienced that period in their lives as well.
It's incredibly illuminative in this book. And I really can't wait for readers to start reading about Ivy Lynn. I'm not sure where you are. I mean, everything just happened so quickly for you this summer between Entertainment Weekly and all these incredible, well-deserved accolades in the bestseller list and all of these things. What is, I don't even want to have the nerve to ask you what's next, because I feel like this is just, and we can't keep it in at work at the library. We cannot keep your book in. It is out everywhere, which is so amazing when you can see that, you know, from months ago. And for you, it's probably been quite a long journey. I mean, I don't know how long it's taken from the start of the writing to where we are now. Is it, you know, a couple of years, 3 years, 4 years, something like that?
Yeah, around 4 years, 1 year to write it, and then 2 years of edits, and then this year when it was in post-production. So yeah, for quite a while. In terms of what's next, it's interesting. You have all these chunks of time as a writer between edits, you know what I mean? Between, like, I'll do a round of edit, but my editor will take a few months. And then this whole year has really been like a lot of PR. So for me, I can't stop writing. Like, I'm always thinking, like, I call myself a serial chapter one writer because I have a million cool ideas. And so for me, writing is my safe place. It's sort of comforting, you know? So to me, the problem is not writing. It's not writing. To me, the problem is really making sure that it's good, or is this the right story that I want to be telling, and really condensing it to a story. So I've been writing, I'm sort of two-thirds into it, into the first draft of my second novel. It deals with identity politics. It's just something that I'm really drawn to. And it's also a love story that follows two people over the span of around 10 years. And it is sort of set in between the US and Beijing, and it follows the guy's career in the entertainment, in the Chinese entertainment industry. So it sort of, again, takes the outsider point of view and looks into a society that's kind of unfamiliar to my narrator. And she is trying to navigate the difference between sort of like the public persona and her private relationship with this man. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well, I'm very excited about that now. I just got the chills. And I'm sure your editors are like, yay, go Susie.
Yeah. They're always saying, oh, what is it about? When can I read it? And I'm like, not until I'm finished.
It must be very hard for you to just sort of read for pleasure. Is there anything though that you have read other than the Elena Ferrante piece? Anything else that you would recommend?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, actually, I would say that we talked earlier about the labels of the career labels. I would actually put the label of reader ahead of my label as a writer, because I will never stop reading. Like, I would rather stop writing than to stop reading, like, genuinely.
Editor, and so she didn't mean that. There's a time difference. Don't worry. She
Like, I could never stop reading other books. You know, they're really just such a pleasure for me. So, and I actually start writing every day by reading a book that I love. So one I would recommend is, because I've been based in the UK for the last 2 years, I've been into a lot of English authors, and I really love Alan Hollinghurst. I discovered him when I moved here. Have you read him? Oh, so I read The Line of Beauty.
Oh my God.
Which is, it's so good. Oh my God. I'm so happy you read it, because I mentioned it.
Good.
It's so good. Oh my gosh. I gulped that one down, and it's so evocative and it's so fresh. I love that one. I've been recommending that one. And I've also really loved the Patrick Melrose series. I don't know if you've read that.
We got it.
Love that. Okay.
In the library.
Well, I can't even recommend you any books. Yeah, I can't even recommend you any books.
Well, it's just that, I mean, like you said, if my main thing is to be a reader. And when those books came out, we bought them, gosh, I don't even know how long ago, for the library, but it actually came out in an omnibus. So all of the books were together in one.
That's the one that I, in one volume. Yeah. And I read them straight through. The big one.
Oh my gosh.
I love that one.
I was obsessed. And then when it came
out, I read them all in one sitting. Yeah.
Was it Netflix that did the?
It was HBO with Benedict. Yeah.
Listen,
yeah.
If you find him or you sight him on the streets, you've got to, like, send me an email that he walked right past something. Is that what
I wish. Yeah.
That's great. So Hollinghurst and the Patrick Melrose novels are just really, really.
They're wonderful.
And I read a lot. Like, part of what my job as a librarian is to not only just read for work, but I read for pleasure. And it, you know, to the point where my husband's like, remember me?
So, yeah.
Yes. So where can readers find the latest and the greatest from Susie Yang? What's your social media? Where can people look you up to see where you might be speaking next or Zooming next or where they can find info about you?
My website is susiebooks.com. And so I'll have some the podcasts that I do that come out. And so people can watch them. And I think it's really great because now everything's recorded. So there's no need, you know, to try to make an event if people are busy. I'm mostly on Instagram. I'm at Susie Y Yang. That's my Instagram. And then I'll share events that I'm doing on Instagram usually.
I will put all the links for all of those social media outlets on the podcast page and people can see you there. What are you doing the rest of this week? Do you have more of these Zoom discussions or podcasts coming up or interviews, book clubs?
Yeah. So next week I'm recording the segment for the Read with Jenna pick for the Today Show. So that's going to be coming out. I think actually it's coming out on Black Friday. So hopefully everybody will be in a shopping mood. You know, at least that's what my team is hoping. Everybody will just be shopping and buying books online on Black Friday. So I'm recording that. I think I have some more events in December for Canada, actually. I have a few Canadian events coming up as well.
That's great. So like I said, everybody, you can find all of those links on the podcast page for episode 46. Listeners, can you believe it's episode 46? I don't know how we got here, but I couldn't do it without all of the fabulous authors that have joined us and all of you guys as listeners. I am just so appreciative, and 'tis the season to be thankful in more ways than one. So I am really thankful to all of you. And Susie Yang, I cannot thank you enough for joining me today on Merrick Library's Top Shelf. What a terrific interview. You're a gem.
No, this is such an honor. This is really fun. And it flew by.
It did fly by. I can't believe it. All right, listeners, thank you so much for joining us today. Remember to follow Top Shelf at Merrick Library on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and wherever you find most podcasts for the latest and the greatest at the Merrick Library. Check out our website, merricklibrary.org. Special thanks, as always, go to Merrick Library Director Dan Chusmere, Assistant Director Diane Bondi, and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and onto the airwaves. Until the next time, remember to keep us on your top shelf.